ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
The coronavirus pandemic has impacted all of us in Wisconsin. But here in Milwaukee, some members of our community have been particularly hard hit. Four Milwaukee zip codes show the highest incidence of infection. Two are predominantly African American and two Hispanic. On this edition of UWM Today, we take a closer look at why Milwaukee is facing what Governor Tony Evers called a crisis within a crisis. Our guests are three faculty members at UWM's Zilber School of Public Health: Amanda Simonek, who's an associate professor of epidemiology; Lorraine Halinka-Malko, also an associate professor in the same area; and Mustafa Hussein, who is an assistant professor of public health. We welcome all of them to today's program. They're all closely following the way in which COVID-19 is affecting our community. Well, first, let's start with the numbers. And Lorraine, I want to start with you in terms of what we see in terms of who is suffering the most when it comes to COVID-19 here in southeastern Wisconsin.
So if we take the county as a whole, Milwaukee County, as of this morning, there were a little over 2,800 people who have been diagnosed with COVID-19. And of those who, we know that a little over or a little under half, so 43.5% at the county level are African American, whereas they represent only 27%. Of the population. So that's like about, you know, 1.5 times their rate in the population. And then in the level of the city, if we look at the, and if we look at the, not just the cases, but we also look at the deaths, then people who have died, there's 168 people who have died from coronavirus, and a little over half are African American, even though they represent about 39% of the city. So again, that's about 1.3 times their percentage in the population. Among Hispanics, represent about 15% of the county, and they're about 19% currently of the cases. There are only 8 deaths that have been recorded among Hispanics. So that's a very low percentage, but I think that's primarily a reflection of the fact that the outbreaks that have impacted Hispanics are more recent, and so people are just newly diagnosed. So that, you know, there's a large lag time, of course, before we end up seeing people who've died from coronavirus after they're diagnosed.
The numbers that we see here in Milwaukee are mirrored in some other large cities, aren't they, Amanda? We've seen places like Detroit or in Chicago, for example, also with a fairly significant difference between the African-American infection rate and whites.
Yes, I would agree that we're seeing these same patterns of a greater proportion of African-American and Hispanic populations being adversely, more likely to be exposed and then had to suffer adverse complications from coronavirus.
Yeah. Mustafa, the reasons behind it?
The coronavirus landed in a context of historical legacies of racism and discrimination and continued institutionalized racism that reduce African Americans and minorities in general access to resources and jobs that could protect them from economic consequences that might come with something like coronavirus. So there is continued disinvestment in these minority communities with manifestations like stereotyping and interpersonal discrimination, concentrated poverty and lack of resources, and in particular low-wage work that exposes people to a variety of exposure risks. And then there's also crowded housing and unsafe environments that that people might have to negotiate their increased reliance on public transit. And also, the structural racism that has been around and the poverty that minority communities have suffered for a long time, and living in poor, disinvested neighborhoods have led to disproportionate exposure to disease risks, and from air pollution to toxins like lead and so on. And that also made them bear the brunt of the burden of chronic conditions that could also make them more likely to die or suffer significant clinical outcomes, poor outcomes from COVID-19.
Amanda, as you as a person who devotes her life to the study of public health issues, it sounds as Mustafa described some of the reasons for these disparities. It sounds as if we shouldn't be surprised that COVID-19 has had this much greater impact on the African American population, because those conditions existed long before COVID-19 ever came along.
Yeah, the social determinants of health that lead to health disparities in socioeconomic disadvantaged populations, those factors are already there and already causing health inequities. So in the instance of a pandemic, right, something where the very measures that we're asking people to partake in to socially isolate, to protect themselves are not able to be equally taken up across the population. And really, it's the people who can work from home, who have, the luxury to engage in social distancing, that are going to benefit the most from those kind of recommendations. So this situation is really just exacerbating those inequities that already exist by the sheer fact that the measures we're asking people to take to protect themselves and their community are not equally accessible across the population.
And Lorraine, from your standpoint, I know you've also taken a look at a subset of minorities, people who are incarcerated, where there is particularly great risk, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah, so really all what we call, congregate living facilities. So these are any kind of setting and where people are living together in a group situation, increases tremendously the risk of coronavirus and of outbreaks. Prisons in particular are really a major source of infection. And they're a major source of infection also for communities, right? So we have the staff moving in and out of the facilities. And one of the things that's really important, and I'm not sure everyone really understands this, is that a very high percentage, we believe, of people are asymptomatic, yet still spread infection. And that can be 1 in 4 of people who are infected, or it could be even higher than that. I mean, the numbers are kind of all over the place. It's really hard for us to know the exact percentage. But if we assumed on average that 1 in 4 people who are infected show no symptoms and are transmitting it to others, then the way that people are going about doing prevention, which is to say screen healthcare workers or screen workers, right? Any kind of setting where people are in close proximity, whether it's at a meatpacking plant or whether it's in a nursing home or whether it's in a prison or a jail, if the people who are going in and out of those facilities are only being screened by having their temperatures checked and asking them symptoms, you're going to miss 1 in 4 people who are actually infected and can spread it to others. And so what's happening is that the staff, the prison staff and jail staff, are going in and out of the facility, and they are likely, particularly in like some Milwaukee, where we have widespread community spread of the virus, then they're going in and out of the facility and they're basically transmitting it to the incarcerated people inside.
Yeah.
And once it gets a foothold, it spreads rampantly. And it's a very serious danger, of course, to people inside. these correctional institutions because there's a very high percentage of people who have these underlying health conditions, and there's a high percentage, I mean, over 20% of the prison population are over 50.
In terms of the health department and the emergency government team that has been monitoring the situation from the outset of COVID-19, how aware, how concerned are they of what's happening in the jails, in House of Correction, for example?
I mean, I don't think I can speak directly on behalf of their awareness. I know that in the House of Corrections, there was an outbreak recently, and that there was a mobilized effort to test detainees there to try to get a handle on, you know, how many people might have been infected, and that we should be doing contact tracing in those settings as well.
Yeah, yeah. Lorraine, I know that you and others have raised the issue of releasing inmates from our jails in light of the high infection rate. Where do we stand on that front?
Well, there have been some, I mean, in terms of our efforts, there have, for the prisons, for the state prisons, the governor and the state have not done anything more than they were already doing since we started our efforts. We contributed public health information and statistics and background information for a lawsuit that was filed by the ACLU to try to get more people released, and that was eventually dismissed by the Supreme Court of the state. There are efforts being done at local levels to try to get people released from jails, and I think that has been somewhat more successful, but it is not being tracked in any systematic way that I'm aware of. And really, I think that there is simply not enough effort being placed on decarceration. It is not possible. I cannot stress this enough. It is not possible to socially distance in prisons and jails. And so all of the efforts that people are making to supposedly make it better and to screen employees is not sufficient, because if people are asymptomatic, because they're not doing widespread testing except in the House of Corrections. And so, in fact, the testing rate in the state under DOC is abysmally poor. They've tested less than 200 people, and there's 23,000 people incarcerated. They're not systematically testing the staff. You know, across the country, over 130 incarcerated people have died, and over at least 13 staff have died across the country in prisons. That's not even counting jails. So yeah. This is a very, very serious problem. And some recent report that was sponsored by the ACLU, but it was in collaboration with three different university partners, found that at least 100,000 cases will occur in communities across this country because of the spread from jails and prisons. Yeah. So we cannot, even if you were willing, which we as public health people, of course, are not at all willing to do, even if you were not caring about what was going on with people, with incarcerated people, and we do not feel that they are disposable. We think they're human beings just like everyone else. But even if you weren't concerned about them, you should be concerned about what's going on in your communities. And what has been shown in Wisconsin is that many of the state prisons are in communities that are rural and have very, very low capacity for ICU beds, for example. So there might be a large area that has only 24 ICU beds, but it's got thousands of prisoners and hundreds of people working in the prison.
And those hundreds of people are coming in and out.
They're coming in and out, exactly. And so, you know, if an outbreak occurs there, it will immediately and very quickly overwhelm the healthcare system in those areas.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujak, and joining us this week are three members of the Zilber School of Public Health faculty at UWM. Our focus is on COVID-19 and the disproportionate incidence of infection of COVID-19 among African Americans here in Milwaukee. Amanda Simonek, Mustafa Hussein, and Lorraine Halinka Malko, all of our guests today. Mustafa, let me pose this question to you. All three of you, and the rest of your colleagues on the faculty at School of Public Health, have in your training studied the possibility of a pandemic. You've considered what would happen if something like COVID-19 came along. How well prepared do you think we have been, both here in Milwaukee, and I guess we should broaden that nationally? Did or could anybody have ever seen this coming?
So I think a lot of people had seen this coming as early as early January, including at top government levels, both at the federal government and maybe some other state governments as well. I've read reports about knowledge of possibility of an epidemic in New York early in January. And so I think we have lagged behind in terms of preparing ourselves for responding appropriately to this possibility, including preparing testing capacity, personal protective equipment, and making sure that we're ready to take on the surge of people who may get infected. And I remember, I remember once reading a comment from a public health expert that says, being a week late, a week behind in responding is problematic. Being 2 weeks behind is disastrous. Being a month behind, which we were at least a month behind in terms of responding, is just a catastrophe. So yes, unfortunately, we have been behind. I think we're trying to catch up, but there's a lot more work to be done, including in particular increasing testing capacity and addressing the inequalities that we have been talking about today. Because, I hope people are now seeing that inequality is no longer a personal matter. No longer the poor people or the minorities are being affected by their social standing and their living and working conditions, but everyone in the community is being affected by those stark levels of inequality that we have in society today.
Amanda, a lot of us, I think, have scratched our heads and reacted with confusion and maybe even some shock as some governors of states where the number of cases are still growing have decided to turn the switch back on and say, we've had enough. We're going to open up the beaches and the restaurants and the barber shops. From a public health standpoint, how do you explain that, given the fact that there seems to be evidence that that is moving us backwards?
Well, from the very beginning, people were saying, if the public health measures we enact start to work, and it will look like they were never necessary in the first place, right? And that's the danger. We are flattening the curve in many places, but that's because of these extreme measures of social distancing that's occurring. One strong danger in releasing or relaxing those social distancing measures prematurely is that before we actually have met any of these gating criteria for reopening, before we've seen a decrease in cases to the level that could be managed through other public health measures like testing, contact tracing, quarantine, and isolation of cases, if we reopen back up, relax these measures, we will see a second surge in cases where we will have a spike in cases that's even greater than what we would have had originally had we, sort of not gone into social distancing. And so there is a strong danger in prematurely reopening and sort of scaling back on these measures.
Lorraine, you, along with your colleagues, teach public health. We have students who come from all over the country to the Zilber School, which, by the way, is the only accredited school of public health here in the state of Wisconsin. Have you had a chance to interact with students since this all began? And what is their take on first of all, how we're responding as society, but also, you know, the fact that these students are training to become public health experts in the future?
Yes, I mean, I'm teaching an undergraduate class now. It's called, you know, From Cells to Society. And since the COVID-19 pandemic has happened, I asked the class, we were previously focusing on the opioid crisis as our kind of application of learning. And since the pandemic, I asked them, do they want to focus? What would they like the focus to be? And virtually all of them really wanted to focus on COVID-19. And I think they are really, you know, as they're learning the basic principles of public health and understanding, you know, as Amanda said, the social determinants of health, they are really surprised, I think, and kind of taken aback especially, you know, the federal response or the lack thereof. I think they're also very excited about being able to be part of, you know, future pandemic responses, and they want to learn as much as they can about, you know, how as public health practitioners, you know, what is the correct way and the best way to prevent these kind of pandemics and to prevent the worst consequences of them.
Mustafa, how about you? How about your students? Same reaction?
So I'm actually teaching a class now on methods for studying population health and health inequalities and evaluating policy effects. And we try to talk a lot about how some of the techniques we're studying may apply to studying COVID-19 and evaluating the effects of government policies and aid packages, and perhaps how those could be improved to lift up everyone and reduce the financial precarity that people were put in because of this. So, you know, these are very interesting conversations, and I'm glad that our students are engaging with them now so that they are prepared to tackle them when they go out in the real world.
Amanda, I have to ask, we began the program discussing the disparities, the racial disparities and the incidence of COVID-19. Do you think any good will come from this this pandemic, where we might take another look at our community, at our society, to determine how we prevent this disparity among African Americans and whites from continuing in the future?
I think something to piggyback off what Mustafa said is that in the face of the pandemic, none of us are protected unless the most disadvantaged of us are protected in this situation. And I think it's shown a light, although to many of us in public health, that light was already, you know, spotlight on health inequities. It's really demonstrated that all those social factors that influence health and cause adverse health among subsets of our population have only become glaringly more obvious in the face of a pandemic. Hopefully moving forward, this will change the way we think about the responsibility for the population's health.
Yeah. How about you, Lorraine? Are you hopeful?
I guess I don't know what will happen exactly, you know, politically, but I am hopeful that more and more people are organizing and working together to really lift up those who are most vulnerable. And people are fighting for, you know, workers' rights. People are advocating for the need to, you know, cancel or waive rent payments right now, or mortgage payments, to restore, you know, people's water, to get people access to food. I was very happy to see, you know, as soon as they shut down the schools, they moved very quickly to make sure that children had access to the meals that they were getting in the schools. So I think that there is a lot of concern in the community to really address these underlying social inequities that lead to the health inequities. And I am very glad to see that so many people kind of on the ground are taking up the call, really, to work together to support the communities, to support one another in their communities.
Yeah, we can only hope that we all see the shared benefit of helping each other out. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I do want to get a pitch in for the Zilber School of Public Health, because this is a time when public health education is in the forefront. People are talking about it. For listeners who themselves may be students or who have children who are thinking of a career, could we spend just a moment talking about the opportunities to connect to the study of public health and make a difference? There are lots of avenues for students to follow, right? Go ahead, Lori.
Sure. So we have a master's in public health program, so which you need a bachelor's to get into, but you can have a bachelor's in almost anything. We have several different areas that you can concentrate on. We also have a new, relatively new, just started this past fall, a new bachelor's of public health, and we're very excited to have new students. This is a program that really shows how public health is connected to really every aspect of society, as well as all the way, you know, to biology. And our students are very excited about learning how public health connects to everything. And that's what our program really does.
Well, a great way to educate folks about the opportunities to perhaps follow in one of your footsteps as people who are leaders in the public health field here in our community. Folks, we're out of time, but thank you so much for taking part of your day to talk about this critical issue of public health and how it can help shape our battle against COVID-19. Amanda Simonek, Mustafa Hussein, and Lorraine Halinka Malko, all faculty members at the Zilber School of Public Health at UWM, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We invite you to join us next week at the same time for another conversation about how UWM and its people make a difference here in the community. In the meantime, stay healthy. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.